Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by someone who will be very familiar to regular listeners of the podcast. It's the return of our former leader and host, Jane Crowther. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. I've missed it. It feels weird, though, you doing that intro.
I know, we've swapped sides.
That is my job. How dare you?
And Jane isn't the only exciting guest we have on the podcast this week. Oh, no, this is an absolutely bumper episode overflowing with interviews, including Jake Gyllenhaal, Daniela Melchior, Lucas Gage and Billy Magnussen, who are talking about Roadhouse, director of Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, Gil Keenan, the star of religious horror Immaculate, Sydney Sweeney, and the showrunners of new Netflix series Three Body Problem. That's David Benioff, D.B. Weiss and Alexander Wu. And
my God, that's so many people.
There's so many.
What a bumper issue.
And we're also going to be reviewing some of those films, as well as found footage horror Late Night with the Devil and animated gem Robot Dreams. But first, Jane, have you been watching anything this week besides these films?
I've been sort of getting into my Liz Taylor, Richard Burton vibe. I'm reading a book about them and their sort of enduring love affair, which is fascinating. And so I've sort of wanted to watch them again on the screen. So I've watched Cleopatra, obviously. I've just watched The Sandpiper, which I'd never seen, which is them a year into their sort of first marriage, filming in Big Sur and gorgeous views. And they film at a restaurant that I love in Big Sur called Nepenthe. It's them in the sort of throes of their passion. But yeah, I'm going to be trying to revisit them in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and various other things. Yeah, so my old Hollywood is what I'm getting into. What about you?
That's quite classy, yeah. Well, this week I've sort of been lucky to see a couple of South by Southwest films, including Monkey Man was one of them. I saw Dev Patel's directorial debut.
Can't wait to see that.
Yeah, very, very intense, very enjoyable. Also saw Civil War as well, another South by Southwest film, which, again, very intense. I had a few qualms about it, but interesting film. We'll obviously talk about that in a bit more depth when that comes around soon. That's coming out in a few weeks. And I also, like probably pretty much every other Disney Plus subscriber, I did watch Taylor Swift The Eras Tour, Taylor's Version, over the weekend.
I still haven't seen it. I need to.
Obviously, you got to get 3.5 hours spare for it, but especially if, like me, you didn't manage to get tickets to the tour, it is very good. It's very enjoyable. And it's very nice to be able to watch it from the comfort of your own home as well, to be honest, and have a great view and not just be up in the gods kind of staring down and kind of watching on a screen there anyway, really. So I did enjoy that kind of civilized way of viewing it, I must admit.
You did have to queue for the toilets.
Exactly.
Or did you do that? Did you make the family do that and then, you know, get yourself a underwhelming hot dog to eat, really have to queue for the tube after?
And put a drink in a plastic cup.
Yep.
Should have done that.
Did you wear a friendship bracelet?
No. I just fully embraced being at home.
I don't think you did it properly.
I fully embraced being at home as in pyjamas, dressing gown, just, you know, sofa, just enjoying that side of it. But yes.
Boring!
I did find it very enjoyable. And I found, I'm not a Taylor Swift super fan. I obviously very much, as most people do, I very much enjoy a lot of her music, but just so many bangers in there. Yeah, just a great show. And I did think, because it's so long, I thought, is my attention going to wander a bit over this? Am I just going to sort of check out a bit and start, you know, looking at my phone or being distracted by other things? But I really did find it engaging for the whole time. And it's just pure show. There's no kind of backstage element or anything like that. Yeah, really enjoyed that. So that's what I've been watching this week.
Yeah, I will be watching that as soon as I can. But I'll probably try and do it like without the pajamas and try to sort of have a little disco in the lounge whilst I'm doing it. And I'm obviously feeling bittersweet when I hear 1989 being any of those tracks being played, because that is obviously a Total Film soundtrack.
That's a very good section, yes. Right, so on to new releases now. And first up, it's time to take it outside.
Before we start, do you have insurance?
What?
Your coverage good? Like, you have dental?
Oh, haha.
Is there a hospital nearby? Is it, like, too far?
About, like, 25 minutes, I'd say.
I just slapped you. Are you all right?
What?
So you like to fight. You ever win?
No one ever wins a fight.
So this is Roadhouse, the contemporary reimagining of the Patrick Swayze favourite from 1989. This new version stars Jake Gyllenhaal in the Dalton role, and it transplants the basic story, which involves like a cool badass bouncer protecting a sort of preyed upon saloon. And it transports it from Missouri to the Florida Keys. And it also gives Dalton this UFC backstory here. And before me and Jane review this film, Online entertainment writer Molly Edwards recently spoke to several cast members, including Jake Gyllenhaal, Daniela Melchior, who plays Dr. Ellie, Lucas Gage, who plays fellow Roadhouse employee Billy, and Billy Magnusson, who is a nefarious local businessman with designs on the Roadhouse. So here's what they had to say.
Let me guess. You know, threaten me. Tell me to get out of town. I get the impression that you can't be threatened.
Once Knox is on the job, it's over, baby.
It takes a lot to get me angry, but when I am, I just can't let go.
People seem a little aggressive around here.
So first, huge congrats on the movie. I thought it was amazing. I really loved it. And Jake, I want to start with a question for you because you, of course, worked with Patrick Swayze on Donnie Darko and now you're playing the role of Dalton. So did you kind of take inspiration from the way that he played it or were you very keen to kind of put your own spin on the character?
There's an essential part of Dalton that I loved and it was definitely a characteristic, a personality trait that Patrick had in spades. Which is this sort of quiet patience, you know. What I love about the original Dalton and also this one is that Dalton that I play has, I think, a bit of more absurd humor to him, you know, is sort of his observations are always a bit wry. There's a real power in his stillness. And I definitely brought that from Patrick's interpretation.
And Daniela, I have like a similar question for you because your character also existed in the original, but you're playing like a very different spin on her.
Yes.
So I was wondering, like, what did you make of the changes and how did you feel about sort of putting your own sort of take on the character?
Mm-hmm. I think since I read the script, I noticed that Ellie would be totally different than Elizabeth. Yeah, she was just a badass. And I noticed right away they wouldn't go as a common or like a conventional couple go on any other movie. And it made sense to me because it's fresh, it's real, it's way more relatable to nowadays. Yeah, and definitely working in the DR, surrounded by Dominican girls, I feel that I also, in the moment, took a bit of that like warm blood from the Latinas a little bit to Ellie, yeah. She's definitely like unapologetic and everything. Yeah, I took a bit of the location itself to the character.
And both Roadhouse movies are very inspired by like the classic westerns. Like, and I know the kind of structure very much inspired this one. But I was wondering, like, did either of you take inspiration from the classic westerns in other ways?
Doug and I watched Unforgiven before we started the movie, just in terms of structure and character and sort of stillness. Like I was saying, there's like a real sense of kind of tough calm, you know, to those characters. Little is said with words, but then a lot is said with behavior. Yeah, I think that the genre is used, you know. You have a guy coming into a small town, you know, with a past that he doesn't, you know, that he's dealing with, and then, you know, all the townspeople are being taken advantage of, and then he's asked to defend them, and then he gets himself into more trouble than he should, you know. What's great about this movie is that, you know, you have, like, Hannah, who is there playing the girl in the bookstore. She always like comes out and is like our narrator and sort of making a bit of fun of the structure of the story. And that's kind of the nature of this movie, is there's always a bit of a wink, you know, through most of it. But yeah, the Western trope is definitely a massive part of this movie.
I want to start a question for you, Billy, because you're kind of playing a very different take on a character who did exist in the original. So how did you find kind of like putting your own spin on sort of this version of the figure that you're playing?
You know, I, like a centrifugal force, I did not spin it. Like it was its own character. I don't want to compare the past film with the modern day film because I don't think entertainment should be like competitive. Piece of art is a piece of art,
yeah.
And let it be what it is. Doug Liman invited me into this film and I just wanted to create a character that was the bad guy. And that was you want to hate this guy. So that's what I tried to do.
He's a very fun bad guy.
Oh, you liked
yeah.
him.
Yeah,
fun?
Yeah, fun,
I think
yeah.
he, I mean, yeah.
He's fun to hate. You love to hate
him. You
know,
you feel bad for him.
You do feel bad for him.
Yeah.
He's a wounded guy.
Yeah,
he is.
He's hurting on the inside.
And Lucas, you kind of, you know, we've seen you in like Euphoria and The White Lotus before, but this kind of like action role maybe feels quite different for you. Like, how did you find kind of like approaching a more action-y role, which feels like maybe quite different from what you've done before?
It was definitely a challenge to do something that physical. I'm usually getting beat up and things, so to finally beat somebody up was really fun. It was a boulder dash to finish from start to finish. We have a game where we have to give each other a word to use.
No, you can't tell people.
Boulder dash was my word. How was I going to do boulder dash in an interview? I mean, just that's so hard. Anyway, it was a challenge, and it was hard, but it was rewarding, and I've never had to get in shape for anything before. I'm still a little weak, but it's okay.
I'll ask you both about working with Conor McGregor, who is just so much fun in the film. Obviously, he's a very, very much a real UFC sort of fighter. So yeah. How did you find working with him on the action scenes that you had with him?
It was great. He was fun. Yeah. I actually felt more safe with Conor McGregor beating me up than any other person on this film. He knows how to throw a punch and how to not hit you.
Yeah.
Nice. Fun fact.
That's good. That's what you want.
He was a gracious scene partner. You know, he was curious. He was excited to show up every day. And, like, you always hope to work with actors like that. Sometimes in this industry, you don't. So it was nice and refreshing to work with someone that was excited and hungry to learn.
I want to ask you about the live-action Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah.
Because the original is one of my favorite films
ever.
Mine too.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask, how is the live-action shaping up compared to the animated?
Again, like, I don't think you can compare pieces of art to each other. And, like, I adored working with everyone in this, you know. Yeah, Rideback was the producing house making this film, and I did Aladdin with them. Again, it's a story about connection and a kid trying to find a friend. And, like, all you can do is approach a project like that with love. I am so grateful and honored to be a part of that project.
So that was the cast of Roadhouse. So, Jane, I kind of set up a little bit before then, and obviously kind of regular readers will know this is our current cover film. What did you think of this film?
So we saw it quite early, so before sort of the South by Southwest sort of fever had happened, and it did play well there. But as we're discussing, we're not really sure about South by Southwest and whether the audiences there are just really sort of enthusiastic, because it does seem like a lot of films that come out of there are very well received, or if it's just that they really managed to program it brilliantly and all the films are bangers. So we saw this quite early, and I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I don't have a softer spot for it as you do. I know it's very dear to your heart, the original with the Swayze.
Mm.
So I didn't have that sort of real connection to it, and I don't know it as well as you. So therefore, it wasn't really a problem to me that anything had changed dramatically. It was still the same sort of bare bones of it. And I really, really sort of like watching Jake Gyllenhaal, I realised when I watched this. I just think he's really good at injecting a lot of backstory into anything. And this could have been incredibly one note. And, you know, it is a bit The Wrestler, you know, a man who's been through a difficulty professionally and is wounded in every way, physically, mentally, you know, monetarily. And Jake does bring that sort of wounded beast to this, and the fact that you don't want to make him angry. He's a bit Hulk in this. So he's really impressive from an acting point of view, but also physically. We've seen the posters, we've seen the pictures of him. He's ripped, he's totally shredded. And so for someone to go up against him who would be an adversary worthy of that, they've picked this absolute wild dog, crazy guy, you know, Conor McGregor, who is a real UFC superstar. And so brings this real dangerous energy. You honestly believe that he could snap anyone like a twig, because he probably could. And he just is really playful. And so I really enjoyed the two of them together squaring off, and the ridiculous stunts. This is another sort of stunt-laden thing, as you would expect from Doug Liman. Yeah, it's just a good time, a party. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I had a very similar experience overall. And it was one of those films that I totally sort of grew up on. And I rewatched it before, like not long before seeing this one, because I just to get myself in the mood and sort of revisit it. And it was one of those things, I hadn't seen it for absolutely years. But, you know, when you throw on a film and literally every line you could kind of finish, you know, you just know exactly what's coming. And it was all kind of flooding back to me in this sort of nostalgic way. And so I've just got a tremendous soft spot for it. But then I suppose with this one, what I liked about it, in addition to what you said, is it does move things on quite a bit. So you don't just feel like it's just completely, they're just doing a carbon copy of the last one. They are kind of, in the way that I suppose you often want a remake to do, it is transplanted to a new setting. it does feel slightly different, you know, like they have tweaked the characters. It's not like it is just exactly the same formula as before. And compared to a lot of these sort of nostalgic remakes,
there's no throwbacks to it.
Yeah, there's a really small handful, but it's really not bogged down. I thought they would be doing like all the lines, and I thought, you know, they would just be constantly referencing it, but they're just not. And yeah, like you, I sort of really enjoyed Jake in it. Thought he was very sort of charming and fun, and it just had a nice kind of Friday night tone. It's not like, I wouldn't say it's this mind-blowingly amazing film in that sense. It's not like an absolute classic for the ages, but it's just, to me, it's just a really entertaining Friday night film. And I just think if you just, I mean, we can discuss the fact that it's obviously going straight to Prime Video and not having any sort of cinema release, this one. It's a Prime premiere.
Which has not pleased the director.
Well, no, it hasn't pleased Doug Liman, but I feel like it would play well in a cinema, I've got to say. I feel like it would be a really fun Friday night movie. But I also do think a lot of people are going to watch it on Prime, I'm sure. I'll be surprised if it doesn't have a lot of people just kind of talking about it, and with it just being available there just to watch straight away at home. Again, I think especially if you come to it with those slightly lowered expectations, to me, compared to the average streaming premiere, I did think it was a cut above. You've got that proper like movie star quality in Jake. You've got that sort of really chaotic, dangerous energy that Connor kind of brings to it when he sort of tears through the film. And again, because you just know he has those sort of fighting skills in real life, that just adds this sort of element of danger to it. They've done the fights in this quite unique sort of way that I learned a bit about because I did the cover feature for this one. But basically that they just did this new way of shooting the fight scenes and kind of cutting them together, where it really, really does feel quite intense, like the punches. And it feels like they're not kind of pulling any punches, even though, of course, you know, like they're not fighting for real. But I thought that was nicely done with a nice kind of intensity. And I just thought there was just a nice, like, not taking itself too seriously throughout. There was just some funny supporting characters, just some kind of fun little moments. I thought Billy Magnussen was good fun in that role as well. Very different. He has got an equivalent character in the original, but he's a very different type of character. This is kind of like a younger guy. And another thing that made it quite different for me compared to the previous film, and just made it like a nice easy watch, is it's a really nice location as well.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're fiending to go on holiday, this might help sort of ease those woes, if you want to think about sitting in a deck chair on a sort of atoll in the middle of blue sea drinking beer, which is what they do at one point, don't they? Mm.
It's sort of set in the Florida Keys, but it's actually filmed in the Dominican Republic. Yeah, you just kind of compare to the other roadhouse in the previous film, you actually do want to go there, I think. And you can
Although,
understand
would you,
why.
Though? Because the band play in a cage. I mean, do you ever want to go to a bar where the band need a cage to protect them from the flying furniture and beers?
I mean, it's not the best sign, is it?
I don't imagine their food's any good.
But you understand why they want to clean it up, at least. You understand why that's...
Location. Yeah. It is a beautiful spot, yes. You know, you do get nudity, but not from Jake. But there is some very amusing nudity that I just thought really tapped into Conor McGregor's sort of feral character and his giving zero Fs about anything. Some very interesting bum action that really adds to the plot.
So, yeah, some real cheekiness there, I'd say.
Very good.
So yeah, just very insane, enjoyable. Doesn't reinvent the wheel, but sort of slick, enjoyable fun. Very fun, I would say.
And maybe, do you think it might do like a reverse thing whereby it becomes a hit on streaming and then there's an appetite to put it on a big screen? And maybe it's one of those weird things that goes the other way, and it's something that plays to, you know, audiences that are really into it at the Prince Charles Cinema or something like that. Maybe it'll do it that way around. Mm. But yeah, Doug Liman is not happy about it not going to cinemas first.
It certainly has that vibe that you could imagine these kind of culty showings of it. Yeah, like I said, I'm sure loads of people are going to watch it on Prime, so I'm sure it'll be a big hit. And you could kind of see them revisiting it as well, like maybe be it in a different location or be it just sort of returning with these characters. It's sort of left open enough that things could continue. So I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up being a big hit and warrants that, but be interesting.
He could do a Roadhouse in every state, couldn't he?
He could, yeah.
Start in Florida, work your way around.
So that is Roadhouse, which is streaming on Prime Video from Friday.
I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely nobody.
Next up, it's the return of another 80s favorite.
first time in New York history, people froze to death in the middle of July.
What is it?
The death chill. The power to kill by fear itself. Your veins turn to rivers of ice. Your bones crack. And the last thing you see is your own tear ducts freezing up.
Like, literally scared to death?
So cool.
This is Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. It's a sequel to 2021's Ghostbusters Afterlife, and ultimately the fourth in this timeline of films. It picks up after the events of Afterlife, and now this kind of younger generation of the Spengler family have moved into the New York firehouse, and they're kind of starting their own ghostbusting career with the help from OGs Winston Zeddemore and Ray Stantz. And before me and Jane discuss the film, we're going to hear from the film's director, Gil Keenan, who's been speaking with our senior online TV and film writer, Laura Malisi.
Can you talk about your mission to bring back the OG Ghostbusters as main characters and not just as cameos?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that, well, as a fan, it's what I wanted to see on the screen. Jason was the same. We were so excited to watch them suit up again and take a vital role in this new story. But part of it was actually sort of informed by a change of location. I mean, we went back to New York City with this story. This is home turf for Ghostbusters and for the characters. And we knew that 2 years have elapsed since the fateful events of Somerville, Oklahoma. And I like to think that actually that moment sort of rekindled a flame in all of those characters as well. We kind of see a glimpse of that with Winston in the post-credit scene of Afterlife, when he looks almost to the potential of the future of Ghostbusters. And so this movie created an irresistible opportunity to let those characters thrive.
Afterlife received like some criticism for the location change, and then this one's back in New York. Choosing to kind of bring them back to the original location, the firehouse, have to do with the criticism, or just like, let's do it, let's bring it back?
I'm sure I'm going to get some criticism for bringing it back to New York City. So I think that just goes with making a movie in 2024. It was always, we went to Oklahoma to rekindle a flame. We had to move away from the noise, the energy, the ghosts of New York in order to find something pure. And that something pure was Phoebe Spengler and her family. And that was our building of a kind of thread that connected us back to 1984. That thread leads in the other direction to New York City, where the events of Frozen Empire take place.
Where Afterlife looks backwards, like you said, and connects all the way back, Frozen Empire tries to really seem like it tries to settle like the new generation of Spenglers. How does Frozen Empire kind of juggle both like the past of the franchise and its future?
Through character is the short answer. I mean, Phoebe Spengler is on a journey of discovery, like any young person. This is an adolescent journey of figuring out who you are in this world, what your role is as part of a family unit, one that's actually on its own searching for a kind of definition, some baseline, some grounding. Phoebe's trying to figure out who she is as a Ghostbuster, and that's not an easy task in this film, because there are internal and external challenges to that. What you end up with is an emotional center to the story that gives you an architecture. So the balance of new and old is really just how you can bolster using both the characters and the iconography of the past as a way to explore the central journey for Phoebe, which is, who am I in the grand scheme of ghostbusting? And how do I chart a path forward? And obviously all of that's complicated by the most dangerous, the most violent and menacing adversary that a Ghostbuster has ever faced.
Can you talk about the decision to kind of go away from like Gozer and like create this new like terrifying villain.
I'm really proud of Garaka. I mean, we were so excited to go back to finish the Gozerian saga in Afterlife because it felt like it was a way of settling a score with the past. We almost needed to do that in order to clear the table for new mythologies, new adversaries. And with Garaka, there was an understanding that in this second chapter of the story, we would be creating a much heightened set of stakes, both personally and externally for the city. So Garaka had to sort of carry a lot of weight on his shoulders. He had to be a kind of nightmarish vision that would give all of our characters something unified to have to come together to stand a chance to survive. And in terms of creating the character, obviously there's two parts to this. One is the writing and creating a new mythology that goes back to an ancient civilization that was really fun to write and research. Jason and I did a lot of our writing here in London. We used to go to the British Museum and explore the Hall of Ancient Artifacts as a way to kind of find our own organic way into these story threads. And then visually, I did what I always do, which is I take out a piece of paper and a pen, and I just start drawing something that feels like a pure embodiment of the character that we're writing.
I love the way when Patton Oswalt is like kind of going through the history, the animation that shows the story is so, it was so cool.
Thank you so much. I'm really proud of it. It was something that I added to the film. I grew up with animation. Animation is to me a really vital and dynamic part of film storytelling. And for me, there's not a really hard line between narrative filmmaking and animated filmmaking. I love being able to bring animated sequences to live action films as a way to enhance the experience for the audience. I worked with a small London-based animation house called Studio AKA, who I worked with on my previous film, A Boy Called Christmas, to create a similar pure storytelling sequence. But thank you for calling that out. I'm proud of that scene.
It was so wonderful. So this is technically Ghostbusters 4. Are we looking towards a Ghostbusters 5? And if so, what would you want to see in another Ghostbusters movie?
I'm a greedy fan. I want more and more Ghostbusters fans. I'd be happy if these stories extended out in every direction. I'm happy that we're back in New York City, but I wouldn't mind seeing something that actually goes to other parts of the world. I do feel like one of the things that we explore in this film is that there are mythologies that speak to not just ancient threats, but ancient ghostbusting. That the team in 1984 were not the first to come together to find a way to stop a supernatural threat. I'd love to explore how other cultures, or at least I'd love to see as a fan, how other cultures create specific threats and specific ways to deal with them in future installments.
Okay, so that was Gil Keenan talking Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. So Jane, do you want to set this one up for us?
Yeah. So obviously, if you saw the first comeback film, you'll know that Phoebe and Trevor, the sort of grandchildren of Spengler, battle ghosts in the Midwest. But now everybody's returned to New York. And we open here with a sort of pre-title sequence set in 1904 New York, where this group of adventurers have called the fire crew from the famous firehouse out because they think there's a fire in the building, but actually it turns out everybody's frozen to death with fear. And there is a little globey thing, that's a little brass globe that's discovered. And then we throw forward to the current day when, you know, Mom and Trevor and Phoebe and Gary, Paul Rudd's teacher from the first film, are now fighting ghosts in the firehouse, just as the old team did. But this orb comes back to haunt them because Dan Aykroyd's Ray is currently collecting sort of possessed things, anything that he can find, a doll or jewelry. And he finds this orb, and it's brought into the shop by a man called Nadim, who has found a load of junk in his grandma's house, and it opens a portal. Of course it does, doesn't it always? And New York is once again under threat. There's a lot of people that have added to this and a lot of people that are coming back to this as well. No spoilers, but there are sort of things that people who love the originals will recognize and characters that people who love the originals will recognize. But adding to the cast are Patton Oswalt as a sort of library nerd in the basement of the New York Library. James Acaster as a sort of scientific ghostbuster who is sort of the droll Englishman. And Kumail Nanjiani as Nadine. And Emily Allen Lind, who turns up as a ghostly apparition, Melody, who becomes quite instructive in Phoebe's life. So we've got a lot going on. The Frozen of the title comes from a sort of curse that is unleashed and that it manifests itself as sort of freezing temperatures, shards of ice coming up through the road, ghostly things whizzing about and just general fear. For my money, it's literally following the pattern of the first films. You know, the first Ghostbusters was really contained and a certain story, and then they sort of opened it out to sort of a bigger, wider threat to the whole of the city. I mean, I know that the Marshmallow Man was quite a threat to the city, but in the second one we got, you know, the Statue of Liberty stomping all over the place and it became much more about a bigger threat. And this is following the same pattern. Did it work for you though, Matt? Because it didn't quite work as brilliantly as the first one did for me.
I don't know if I'm going to be a real outlier here, but I actually did really quite enjoy this one. And I'll sort of caveat it by saying I did go in with sort of relatively modest expectations in the sense that I enjoyed Afterlife. But I wasn't like I was absolutely desperate for more. So I kind of wasn't going in like absolutely fired up for this. And I wasn't massively sort of taken by the trailers maybe as well. But I was, again, like Roadhouse, I did very much grow up with Ghostbusters. It was the first two films were obviously kind of, you know, those pivotal films of my youth. So I'm always going to have a bit of a soft spot for Ghostbusters, always going to have a bit of a soft spot for seeing people in boiler suits and proton packs and, you know, those nostalgic hits, getting back to the firehouse, the fire pole, the Ecto One, all that kind of stuff is going to sort of do something to me. So it's going to have some kind of effect on me. So I am susceptible to this, let's put it that way. But I actually found it really well done. I sort of thought it started off well. I liked that prologue kind of element you mentioned. I thought that was in a family friendly way, nicely kind of spooky and sort of set it up in an intriguing way. And then just for me, it just kind of delivered what I sort of wanted from a contemporary Ghostbusters film, I suppose. If I had any sort of big qualms about it, I would say that they do perhaps spin too many characters because it's quite a you know, again, but by blockbuster standards, it's quite a fairly modest running time in the sense that it comes in under 2 hours, which is sort of surprising for this type of blockbuster sometimes. But you've obviously got this, you know, the new family that was introduced. Kids have got some friends in the mix as well from the last film. Then you've got the sort of OG busters who play a part as well. Then you've got these couple of new characters that you mentioned on top of that. So there are a lot of characters to keep spinning. But even that said, I actually liked I thought they all got at least some nice little moments. Most of them anyway, got some nice little moments. I thought I liked the way that they're kind of navigating where Paul Rudd's character, their kind of former teacher, is obviously now dating the mum played by Carrie Coon. And I thought they did that quite well. Again, it's only a small part of the film as it only can be in this sort of film, but they navigated that side of where he's struggling to know how he fits in and whether he is kind of in a sort of stepdad role or whether he should stay back. I thought they had a few nice moments there. Thought some of the other characters got some nice moments. Yeah, maybe a bit overstuffed, but I kind of enjoyed it. And I liked that we see this kind of bigger world to the Ghostbusters in a sense that obviously in the previous film, it's hinted at that Winston's kind of create, you know, he's kind of done well for himself and he's created this whole kind of bigger scientific enterprise sort of surrounding ghostbusting. So that plays into the film here. And I just enjoyed seeing that kind of world building. It just felt enjoyable to me and it felt like there was still a bit more to explore in this world rather than it just feeling done. Yeah. So I just quite liked it. And maybe I'd say it's one of those blockbusters that never truly soared to like the highest levels and never kind of like, you know, for example, never troubled like a 5-star blockbuster or anything like that for me. But I just personally found it very solidly entertaining. But what didn't work for you then, Jane?
It's not offensively bad. It's just really quite fine and mediocre, and at some points a little boring. And I found it sort of dragged a little. It just didn't have that magic of the first one. You know, I sort of got shivers with sort of and was delighted to see the little Marshmallow Men in Target the first time, and you know, Spengler sort of returning as a ghost and things. And also that heritage, you know, that Jason Reitman was directing it and that Ivan Reitman, the original director, was sort of on hand as a guiding sort of figure. And in fact, this film is dedicated to Ivan when you get to the end titles. And it sort of feels like there's a disconnect from that in a weird way. It feels a little bit too cynical. Obviously, the first film was cynical. Of course it is. It's bringing back, you know, recognised IP and playing with it and its fan service. But I felt like it did it in a way like that Top Gun did, that it was really cleverly done, carefully done. And even though you knew your gears were being played with, it didn't really feel like that. This one felt a little bit more naked in that. The first one really felt like it was about something else. Ghosts were part of it, but it was about this family trying to come to terms with being stuck in the middle of a different state, being moved away from what they know, and Phoebe learning to sort of come into herself and assess herself and embracing her nerd. And this one tries to sort of do that with sort of impotence. It's about, you know, you're too young to do something or you're too old to do something. They're constantly talking about, you know, Phoebe, you don't know what you're doing because you're too young. You're not old enough to do this. Trevor, you're too young to drive a car. Or the older characters are being told, you know, you're an old man, this isn't for you. You know, your golden years should be about retirement and sitting still and smoking a pipe. So it's sort of about this, how society disregards the young and the old. But then also there's this sort of relationship going on with Phoebe and Melody, this ghost, this young girl who died in a tenement fire, that is sort of queer coded. And I was sort of interested to know where that might go. I was like, wait a minute, are we doing this? But then we didn't. It was literally, it kind of felt like it was queer coding that had turned into queer baiting. So it sort of just didn't quite hang together for me. But if you love Ghostbusters and you want to see Slimer, that's no spoiler. He's, you know, we all know he's coming back. And you want to see other things from those films, then you are going to get to see them. But I just feel like you might feel like you've been played a little.
Yeah, in comparison to what we said about Roadhouse, this does really lean into the references and the callbacks and everything like that. So whether or if that irritates you, you know, it might irritate you here, but I didn't mind it. And I suppose I actually sort of I enjoyed both these recent films. I put them on a sort of fairly similar level for me. And I agree that the Afterlife had a bit more of an emotional pull because of the sort of Egon element to it. But I actually felt like the OG Busters were sort of, I felt like they were weaved in a bit better here, in the sense that they felt like they actually fit into the story and they kind of had their own roles to play. Whereas I did think in the last one, there was just a slight element of like, oh, they've turned
Wheel
up because
out.
They had to turn up basically. And I say this as obviously said, as someone who just grew up loving Ghostbusters, I almost felt they weren't needed in the last one, whereas I did feel that they felt that they fitted in here for me slightly better.
And an old adversary turns up as well, which people might enjoy. I don't know, did you not like, by the time that Paul Rudd sort of literally sort of saying song, yeah, if there's something weird in your neighbourhood, who are you going to call? You're like,
can I just say another thing that's beneficial to me, Jade? Like, so we were at the same screening and I was sitting next to a guy, I have no idea who he was, I'm afraid, but he was laughing throughout.
Oh, he was laughing like
and
a
he
dream.
Absolutely loved every joke, but in a way that I found enjoyable. Like sometimes it can feel sort of, you know, obnoxious or annoying, but he was just enjoying every joke, which just kind of warmed me to it a bit as well. But
whereas I was sitting next to somebody who was hating it actively, so maybe that's why I was leaning more towards the a bit disappointed in it. I don't know.
I'm very intrigued to see what the kind of wider reviews are, because as we record this, it's still embargoed, so you know, there's kind of, we haven't seen a Rotten Tomatoes score yet, or the general kind of picture that people are taking with it. So
I think
it's
going to be all around 3 stars. Mid-range.
Probably won't be that kind to it. And I think, again, if you've got that beef against films that really lean into the nostalgia, you could be irritated by this. So there is that to bear in mind. But I just came away with that feeling that, like, if I just went to see this as a night out, if I knew there's a new Ghostbusters film coming out and I went and paid my money at the cinema, I just felt like I'd be satisfied having seen that. If I would ask for one more thing, it was maybe could have done with a few more ghosts actually. But I thought there was some, I did think there were some nice ghosts in that sense, some nice action scenes. And again, maybe this sounds like faint praise in a way, but just felt very sort of solidly well done throughout.
Solidly is not a not a film term you really want, but, though, is it? Oh yeah, I went to see a solid film. It was perfectly robust. You know, it's if you want the tingles, I just think it's lacking the tingles.
Well, if you do fancy seeing that, that is Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, and that is in cinemas from Friday. I ain't afraid of no ghosts. Next up, we're sticking with the horror theme with this.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hello?
So this is Immaculate, a new horror film set in an Italian convent and telling the story of a young American nun who arrives and ends up getting mysteriously pregnant in a kind of immaculate conception, hence the title, obviously. That nun, Sister Cecilia, is played by rising star Sydney Sweeney. And before we review the film, we're going to hear what she had to say to online writer Megan Garside when they spoke last week.
Out of all the women in the world,
why did he choose me?
How can we trust what's inside you?
I heard that you actually auditioned for this movie about 10 years ago, and it never went forward. Now you have your own production company, you've brought it back. What was the reason for revisiting this project in particular?
I fell in love with this project for multiple reasons. As an actor, it was such an exciting journey to go on. Like, there were so many places that you could go to and explore and push yourself. And I always love characters that kind of take you out of your own element. And then I grew up loving horror films, and I just felt like it was such an interesting take into the genre, where a lot of the fear and a lot of the most horrific scares are all grounded in reality. Like, for Cecilia, a lot of horror films, like, your character tries to run away and escape whatever is terrorizing and haunting that person. But for Cecilia, the scariest thing is growing inside her and she can't escape it.
And it's a really interesting subgenre of horror as well, religious horror. How is Immaculate different to other horror films in this subgenre?
I think that there's a lot of differences. One, we didn't really set out to make a religious horror film. What's interesting is the film was originally set in a boarding school in Ireland. And because the characters were all like 15, 16 years old, and then I was in my mid-20s now, we were trying to find a backdrop and a location that would better serve to the belief of this story. Like, where can you put a girl in her mid-20s in an environment that you believe that she is pure and innocent enough to conceive an immaculate conception? And we were like, nuns, a convent. And honestly, that is how that came about.
And religion is such a sensitive topic as well. What would you say to people who might think that this movie is anti-religious in any way?
I actually have been not discussing anything that has to do with different themes or different diverse of conversations, because I think that what I love about Immaculate is it's going to spark conversation and it's going to spark debate and competing ideas of what they think the film is. And I want to leave that up to the viewer and not have myself put any predisposed ideas in other people's minds.
And as you said, you love the horror genre. There's a lot of discourse at the moment about whether horror movies are getting snubbed at award ceremonies. Do you feel like there should be more representation for horror movies at ceremonies like that?
I would love to see it. I mean, actors put themselves through such crazy transformations and elements and experiences in horror films. And there's been so many incredible films out there. I mean, Barbarian, you have Midsommar, you have Us. Like, there's so many brilliant pieces of art and actors that are bringing these characters to life. And I definitely believe that they should get some recognition.
And after this film premiered at the film festival earlier this week, people have been calling you the new Scream Queen or new final girl of this generation. How do you feel about that?
I mean, it's kind of crazy. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and did you look to any of the final girls in past horror movies for inspiration?
I mean, I've always been a fan of the OG final girl. You've got Jamie Lee Curtis, and I truly think that like John Carpenter and Jamie kind of cemented the term final girl. Like, it existed beforehand, but then they just really nailed it in, and everyone was like, we gotta do that.
Yeah, and in the last scene in particular, you kind of remind me of Sally from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I like the blood on your face and the screaming.
Yeah, right? Oh my god.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that final scene. It's very intense. It's very lengthy. How did you prepare for that?
There wasn't any preparation. We didn't rehearse. We didn't prep it. It was more of just we were tight on location and time and setup. And so we just were like, okay, we'll start the camera here. We'll walk over here and come back. And Mike was like, do you want to rehearse it? Do you want to run through it? And I said, nah, let's just go for it and see what happens. And then we ended up just using the first take.
That was Sydney Sweeney on Immaculate. I kind of set it up a little bit beforehand, Jane, but what did you make of this film?
This is obviously, as you said, Sydney Sweeney playing a sort of devout young woman from America who travels to this remote nunnery that is a place where older nuns are taken care of before they die. And she wants to take her orders and become a sort of bride of Christ, but starts having these sort of nightmares and wakes up pregnant. How's this happened? Everything's still in place. The old hymen's still there. You know, these creepy doctors sort of look into whether she could possibly be pregnant via, you know, the natural means. And it turns out that maybe divine intervention is to blame. And so then we sort of move from a sort of a young girl sort of arriving somewhere and not really understanding her place, and there being sort of sinister overtones, to her really beginning to wonder how this has happened and questioning her own faith and the organization that she's staying with. And so it's chopped up into the trimesters. So sort of first trimester, second trimester, third trimester. And within each of those sections, her suspicions grow as her belly does. So it's very sort of Rosemary's Baby, this sort of creeping suspicion, the idea of a young woman really sort of beginning to understand her lack of agency in this world, that even though it's a nunnery, it is run by men. And it is a very sort of male world that's happening there. And yeah, it sort of reminded me of all sorts of things we talked about when we came out of the cinema, Giallo and Suspiria. Mm. It's feminist horror in a way, in as much as it questions women's agencies over their own body. It's one of those ones that spooky things are happening, but actually you could have a really meaty discussion about reproduction rights and religious iconography, all sorts of things. So from that point of view, it's short and sharp. It sort of gets on with it and reaches the denouement. It is creepy. It is paced in a way that sort of delivers that sort of growing dread. And it does have a lot of things to talk about. So I thought it was quite a smart, well done thing. And Sydney Sweeney, of course, is the producer of this. So it is a Passion of the Christ project for her. And so, yeah, it's quite an interesting move for her as well. Mm. So I think it's worth seeing. Did you like it?
I felt very similarly, yeah. Like, I thought it was, again, one of those films that probably ultimately reaches like a 3-star level for me. Wouldn't say, again, another, you know, not that everything needs to be, but wouldn't say it's like a kind of a classic for the ages. But I did find it just very enjoyable while it was on. It's sort of, like you say, short, sharp. There's something, I do enjoy these films where you just get like immersed in a world like that. And in some ways, not that it's not really particularly similar at all, but just because of the setting, it reminded me of Benedetta a little bit as well, the Paul Verhoeven film from a couple of years ago, just because of the kind of being immersed in that world and the sort of the confines of the convent, I suppose, and the intensity of that. Yeah, there's different elements to it. Like you say, there's that kind of three-part structure to it along the lines of the pregnancy. And so at first you get her uncomfortable feelings of being sort of out of place here and being the new girl there and kind of noticing slightly strange goings on and just these intense new surroundings. And then there's kind of different elements after that. So there's kind of different things to dig into and enjoy. Yeah. And it's got some memorable moments in it. I thought it walked quite a nice tightrope where it was like a bit bit kind of campy, silly, but very knowing, and never went too far that way. So it still did have the power to be quite scary. Maybe a couple of moments that felt a bit too CGI, but lots of kind of memorable things happening in this. And yeah, I just thought it was, yeah, just like a really, especially compared to, like, I mean, you do get a lot of rubbish horror films, don't you, really?
Yeah, like, yes, of course.
The Nun 2, etc., you know. Whereas I feel like this would be, again, for me, it's, if you fancy a Friday night horror, this is satisfying, I think. I think you'll come away, like you say, lots of talk about, you'd be scared a few times. You feel like you've been on a bit of a ride, because it is like quite an intense, confined experience, and it's quite in that sense a bit sort of adrenaline pumped, the way it kind of intensifies as it goes on. Yeah, it's a decent little horror, and a good, very good showcase for Sydney Sweeney as well, I'd say.
Yeah, and also, even though it is a studio picture, you know, it's a decent budget, and it's got, you know, they've put so many, it has that sort of vibe of a indie film. And so it doesn't sort of end on a note that you might expect, which is quite refreshing. It feels like something you might watch at Fright Fest.
Yes.
And so from that point of view, that's quite satisfying too. And also, I think it sort of taps into those feelings of being pregnant, you know, that the first trimester is all about, oh, I feel a bit funny. Second trimester is like, oh God, there's something in me. Third trimester is like, get it out of me. You know, so it is about a female experience dressed up in these sort of horror tropes. So yeah, and if you want to see Sydney Sweeney, you know, drenched in blood, you're going to get that. She gets pretty damn bloody.
So yeah, so a very, very entertaining horror film there. And if you fancy that, that is Immaculate, which is in cinemas from Friday. Next up, we've got an Oscar-nominated animation. So this is Robot Dreams. There's no interview for this week, but you can go back to last week's episode if you missed that and hear the director, Pablo Berger, talking to James Mottram. But Jane, for anyone who missed that, do you want to set this film up for us briefly?
So this was all nominated for animated feature at the Oscars, and it is a silent film, essentially. There's no talking in it. It's a little 80s throwback about a dog called Dog, who is lonely, and he sees a late night ad for a robot that you can build yourself and that can become your friend, orders it, builds it, has a lovely time, takes robot to the beach at Coney Island, but disaster strikes and robot becomes immobile. And really, the rest of the film is the story of their sort of existences without each other over a period of time, for reasons that will become clear when you watch it, and the sort of various scenarios that Robot dreams of in returning to his owner and friend. And it's really a delightful film about grief and moving on and friendship and the friends you can find in when you're not necessarily aware that you're looking for them. It's about the loneliness of big cities. It's about retro stuff. I mean, it's a love letter to the 80s. And honestly, it's truly, truly delightful. I had a little bit of something in my eye several times. I bet you did, because this is the sort of film that would make you blub. Yeah, it's lovely. And I do think it's something that would have won the Oscar had Boy and Heron not been in that category. Boy and Heron gets it because of its, you know, the pedigree of where it's come from and the just out there beautiful imagery in it. But this is really lo-fi and gentle and not as sort of showy as that. But in any other year, I think this would have won the Oscar, because it shows how emotional animation can be, and just the skill of being able to tell a story with no dialogue is incredible, and it absolutely grips you and you feel as though you've watched something as talky as the Woody Allen, you know, even though they haven't said a word. I loved it. Did you?
Yeah, I felt very similar, really. I'd heard good things about it before seeing it, so I went in with high expectations. I was very engaged, enjoying it, into it, kind of, you know, touched by it. But I'd heard some people say it was emotional, and I was thinking, yeah, this is kind of emotional, but, like, you know, I'm enjoying it. But then I just got absolutely walloped by the ending.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, it just completely took me by surprise, without wanting to go into too much detail. But it just, yeah, that it kind of took me by surprise. I didn't really see quite where it was going, to be honest. I sort of thought of it being on one path, and it's kind of on another path. And it's strange because on one level, I mean, again, without going into too much detail, it's not like it's horrendous in certain respects. And I watched it with my son, who's kind of six, and he sort of seemed to enjoy it. And it's very colourful. I really like the animation style, to be honest.
Yeah, it's
sort of
delightful.
Yeah, it almost, like, I mean, partly just because of the robot reminded me a little bit of Bender, just in looks wise, but it reminded me of the style of Futurama in a way, where you've got these kind of, like, really kind of bold colours, thick lines, and it's got lots of little details as well, even though, like, the characters and the colours and everything are quite simple. It's got lots of little details, and you're sort of in New York in the 80s, in another sort of Ghostbusters throwback, you could say. But there's so many just little details that I just really liked in the animation. Like, for example, when you see, like, a microwave meal bubbling away in the microwave into these little globs of cheese, like, bubbling up, just lots of little things like that, which I really liked. Lots of little details. Yeah, like you say, it's interesting because there is just no real dialogue. You're never kind of bored. You fully know what's kind of going on and what people are thinking at all times. And yeah, it's just really, really, like, nicely done. And it's kind of like a Spanish-French film, but not that you really know that, because of there not being any dialogue in it. So it's not like, you know, people have to be convinced to, you know, get on board with subtitles or anything like that. So I hope it does find an audience. And I mean, it's one I could see continuing to, like, be discovered over the years. It has that slight feel of it to me that feels like it's just not one that's ever going to be, like, a massive box office hit. But I feel like people will discover it and kind of share it with friends and stuff as it goes on. And again, it's another kind of sort of relatively tidy, like, 100 minutes or so. So it's not a particularly long film, but you feel like you go through a lot in it. Again, without really going into too many details, I don't know if you felt the same, Jane, but really reminded me of La La Land in certain regards.
And I was going to say La La Land and also Past Lives.
Yeah, just really interesting to have that with with kind of an animated film about a robot and dog sort of relationship. And in some ways it's kind of like we were sort of saying with the, you know, previous film, you can easily apply sort of metaphors here to relationships and growth and grief and things like that, in a way that's not really, like, and that's not even done subtly, if you know what I mean. It's just, to me, it felt very much there, sort of on the surface, but then it just really kind of even just really worked for me, even though it wasn't kind of subtle in what it was kind of doing and that kind of story it was telling. But it just kind of totally worked and totally kind of stuck with me. Yeah, like I said, I really kind of finished it feeling a bit kind of knocked out. And it has this use of Earth, Wind and Fire's September.
Yeah, earworms,
and just, you think, I now think, I'm just never going to be able to hear that song in the same way again, you know?
Without thinking of a roller skating robot.
Yes.
Yeah, it absolutely moved me. And it's one that I can imagine watching again and again, and
same,
popping it on and just finding new things to look at. It also made me feel aggressive towards bunnies. There's some very bad bunnies in this, yeah, that I wanted to really have a shout at. But yeah, no, absolutely delightful. And I also think anyone of any age enjoy this. You can take the entire family. It's a four quadrant movie and you'll get something out of it. And I think everybody will have a little something in their eye.
Mm. Yes. So that is Robot Dreams, which is also in cinemas from Friday. And now we're returning to horror again. It's like a mini Halloween in March this week, with a new take on the found footage format.
You're meddling with things you don't understand.
Whoa! Now, as you know, here on Night Owls, we think it's very important to keep an open mind. Please welcome Dr. June Ross Mitchell and Lily, the young subject of the book, Conversations with the Devil.
I really don't think it's a good idea, Jack. She's becoming more unpredictable.
That's a good thing. That's why we still do what TV. Ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned for a live television first as we attempt to commune with the devil.
So that was Late Night with the Devil. Jane, do you want to sort of intro this for anyone who hasn't heard of it?
It's taking a sort of a usual trope of possession and handing your soul over to the devil, but via late night TV in the sort of late 70s. It follows, a TV host called Jack Delroy, played by David Dasmalchian, who basically is going up against, you know, the big boys and wants the ratings, desperately wants the ratings, always falling behind. You know, he gets to sweeps season and he's like, something has to change. But he's, you know, a member of this sort of sinister sort of gentleman's club. We suspect something dodgy may be going on. So he puts on this show that is during sweep season that he is sure will compete with the Johnny Carsons of this world. And he's got a psychic, he's got a cynic, he's got a girl that was previously taken into a sort of devil worshipping cult. And he puts them all on this show, but what happens during the show? I don't think anyone's going to be surprised by what happens. And, and it does go to quite extremes. There's heads bursting into fire, etc. But it's quite a nice version of this. I mean, we sort of know the sort of the feralness of TV execs and the sort of competition that goes on. And you could sort of imagine that this might have happened. It's not as found footagey as Blair Witch, which I didn't love because of that shaky camera work. So it's not as sort of lo-fi as that or Paranormal Activity. It's a little more slick. Mm. But the sort of the era is really well captured and it really does feel like you're watching that kind of show. So yeah, quite enjoyed it. Did you?
Yeah, it kind of plays as a lost episode, doesn't it, really, in that sense. So it's kind of found footage, but professionally done for the TV. And yeah, I felt largely similar overall in that I enjoyed it, like you say, very, very nice kind of period detail. And I like the idea of it. It was nice to see David Dasmalchian getting a sort of lead role where he's kind of had like scene-stealing performances in loads of like massive films. Like the first film I really noticed him in was The Dark Knight. But he's been in loads of Denis Villeneuve films. He's in Oppenheimer. He's just popped up. He's totally that guy, isn't he?
That we always talk about. You know, like when somebody comes on screen, you're like, I know that guy. What? And you have to look him up because you're like, what have I seen him in? They're like, oh, he's that guy. He's totally that guy. So this is his lead.
So he's done absolutely loads. And it was like a fun idea. I didn't find it entirely satisfying overall, I suppose. Mm. Felt to me a bit like an episode of Inside Number 9. Maybe. Mm. And it also reminded me a lot of This Time with Alan Partridge. Like, I'm a big Alan Partridge fan. And that has the sort of like, you know, it's the faux TV variety show. And then you get these little like behind the scenes bits when they go to ad breaks as well, which that felt very This Time with Alan Partridge to me.
I don't think he ever sort of communed with the devil, didn't Alan, did he?
Well, I wouldn't put it past him.
Well, you know, yeah, exactly. He probably would do something like this for ratings, wouldn't he?
Yeah. I just sort of enjoyed it, but I was never like hugely scared and didn't come away like hugely satisfied by it. But I thought it was like just like a nice, fun idea. Like you say, go to some quite OTT places in an enjoyable way. There's some sort of enjoyable gore as it goes along. Yeah, it's just a kind of intriguing idea. Nicely done. Tight little 90 minutes. Just quite enjoyable, really, but just I wasn't blown away by it.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to be scared by it. It's more that idea of that era of TV and the fact that it was live and, you know, there wasn't any Ofcom watching. People were, I mean, you know, remember the real life story of Christine, the newsreader who shot herself live on air. Weird stuff like this did happen before, you know, regulators got involved and before shows were slightly behind on their transmissions and things like that. You know, so, you know, this is the era that David Niven's presenting an Oscar and a naked man streaks on stage behind him. You know, it's that era where anything could happen. So from that point of view, it feels like they've really captured the era authentically. But yeah, I don't think anyone's going to have nightmares off the back of it.
Okay, so if you fancy that, that is Late Night with the Devil. And that's in cinemas from Friday.
I can't stand the devil. I mean, he's bang out of order. I think he's an evil, evil idiot.
And now for the last big new title of this week, which is a new Netflix series from the creators of Game of Thrones. And it's another epic, challenging book that's being adapted here.
I have to tell you something. Something insane. But true. About all of us. It started a long time ago.
So this is Three Body Problem, which is a highly anticipated Netflix series adapted from the celebrated novel by Liu Cixin. It's an extremely ambitious narrative to sort of give you the official synopsis. It reads, a young woman's fateful decision in 1960s China reverberates across space and time into the present day. When the laws of nature inexplicably unravel before their eyes, a close-knit group of brilliant scientists join forces with an unorthodox detective to confront the greatest threat in humanity's history. And recently, Deputy Online Editor Faye Watson spoke with Three Body Problems showrunners David Benioff, D.B. Weiss and Alexander Wu. So let's take a listen to that.
Back in 1977, they detected a sequence, called it the Wow Signal.
What's it say?
They are coming.
Who are they?
That's the question, right?
David, you've spoken quite openly about wanting to do something really different from Game of Thrones after ending that show. But did you have any kind of trepidation about Three Body Problems' similarities as another book adaptation?
No, I mean, I think, you know, there's the obvious thing with the opening scene where a young woman sees her father getting horribly murdered, which is hard not to think of what Arya sees in the first season of Game of Thrones. But beyond that, the two book series feel incredibly different. I mean, there's the parallel in that they're both wildly ambitious. They're both these kind of sweeping sagas. It felt really different. And I think part of it for me and Dan was just like getting away from swords and horses and yes, my ladies and so forth. Like being able to put a Lana Del Rey song in the soundtrack or a Radiohead song, like all that stuff seemed fun for us after a decade in Westeros. As much as, you know, working in Westeros was the greatest experience ever and you know, something we'll always treasure. But after a certain point, it's time to move on. And so this one felt very different to us. And it really was different in practice working on the two shows.
And Dan, there's a lot of scientific lingo in this one and high concept sci-fi. Was it quite intimidating to kind of work with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, we knew that one of the biggest challenges was going to be taking so much interesting and amazing material comes out of the science in these. It's not just a dry science lesson. It's a science lesson that ends up taking you to places you've never been, to wonderful, awesome, horrifying things you've never seen. But to really understand those things, to know what you're looking at, you need to kind of at least dip your toe into the pool a bit on the science. So our job, as we saw it on that front, was to make sure that to make the science part of it both accessible and understandable to people and to make it as fun and as visually kind of engaging as we could, so that by the time people get to some of the things that happen later in the series, their appreciation has kind of dimension to it. You know, they're not just watching weird stuff happen, but they have some idea what kind of weird stuff they might be watching and where it comes from. We had a lot of help on this front. We had science advisors who, Babak Ferousi and Matt Kenzie, helped us out with a lot of the different aspects of the scientific material, and the books themselves are very, he does a great job of laying this stuff out and making it really clear, I think, and accessible to a reader, but accessible to a reader and accessible to a viewer are kind of two different things. You know, if a sentence takes some time to process in your brain, you get to put the book down and think about it. If you have to push pause to think about something somebody says on the show or something you saw on the show, it kind of kills the flow of the show. So it was a challenge to find the right balance, but I feel like at the end we did.
And Alexander, how easy was it when you came onto this project to kind of slot in with two filmmakers who worked together for such a long time?
easier than you would think, and really quite natural. I mean, we had some help. I mean, we were brought together by Peter Friedlander, who's someone I had known for almost 20 years, and so whose judgment I trust. He said, "I think you'll really get along," and that helped a great deal. We had overlapped at HBO. Dana, David, and I had overlapped, but we hadn't met because we're in different continents. And we had a lot of friends in common, apart from my own admiration for the work they had done. You know, our friends had told me that you won't find someone who will have a bad thing to say about them. In terms of being good people to work with, I had no hesitation. And then when we met, one thing we discovered is that we also share a very similar approach to how we like to tell the stories and how we like to work. Our workflows were very similar. So with that in mind, it became, I think, a smooth transition into a collaboration where Dave and Dan, who have known each other for decades and have worked together with decades, have sort of, you know, brought me in, and I think we worked quite well together. So easier than maybe I would have feared.
Dan, kind of coming to you next, you kind of reunited with some Game of Thrones cast members in this show. And I was just wondering if there was anyone you approached who wasn't able to come back, or anybody you're desperate to kind of get involved in the future.
Well, we are desperate to get involved. So many of the people that we love and have worked with, we would love to do anything with Peter Dinklage again. And when I read that Kit and Sophie were doing a horror movie together and we weren't involved, I had some of the most serious FOMO I've ever felt in my life. But on this story had its own kind of parameters set out from the beginning, you know, and we kind of had a sense of who would fit and who wouldn't, and who there was a slot for and who there wasn't. So we were very lucky on this one that everybody that we wanted to work with, all the Thrones alumni that we wanted to work with, were willing and able to join us. John Bradley's character, especially, we really wrote for John to highlight a little bit of the real John Bradley for people. Not that he's not that much of a dick in real life, but he's certainly not Samwell Tarly in real life. The more you know John, the funnier it is to think that he's playing Samwell Tarly and playing him as well as he did, because he's a very different person than Samwell Tarly, and he's one of the funniest, smartest, most quick-witted people we've ever been around. We wanted to at least, you know, provide an inkling of that for people. So it was great that he agreed to join us, because it would have been very sad to try to see somebody else do what he did on that front. But with Liam and Jonathan as well, they both had to say yes, and so we were very grateful to both of them for saying yes, because they're two of the finest actors we've ever been lucky enough to work with, and two of the greatest people to be around that we've ever been and have dinner with that we've ever been lucky enough to be around and have dinner with. So the fact that we got to do it again on this was a gift on top of a gift.
And David, obviously we're speaking now as the episodes are already out on Netflix and people are watching them. Do you find that you kind of keep an eye on how people are reacting, or is that where madness lies?
Yes, very much the latter. I think it was second season of Thrones where I was really stressed because I've been reading all sorts of like fan reactions to things online. And I walked over to Dan. I think we're in New York for some reason. But I walked over and I saw you, and Dan looked really relaxed and happy and like he had just had a really good sleep, which was annoying. And I said, "Well, why are you so happy?" And he said, I've given up Googling our show. And I was like, "Well, what do you like?" It didn't even compute. I was like, "What are you talking about? How can you not be like checking?" And he's like, "I just went cold turkey. I just stopped looking. And I've been so much more relaxed ever since I did that." I thought, well, there's no way I'm gonna be able to do this, but I did. And ever since then, I've been like pretty ferocious about avoiding that stuff. So like not looking myself up, not looking our show up, not checking my IMDb. I guess I've checked my IMDb star meter a few times. That's not true. But no, I will never go on Twitter and be like, you know, what are people saying about our show? Because, you know, the truth is, even if there was mostly positive stuff, the bits that will lodge in your brain and stay there like thorns for a really long time, or it's going to be the negative stuff. And for all I know, it's not mostly positive stuff. So why would I want to even go there? So as you say, that's where things get dark, and I'm trying to avoid it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And Alexander, obviously this is a really big story and there's so much more of it to tell. Do you have any kind of idea about, in an ideal world, how many seasons you'd run it for?
Well, the three novels in the trilogy, you know, the novels get longer and longer, so I wouldn't say it maps out exactly to three. We have some really strong ideas about what to do in a season two, and then it's a little hazier down the line. But we want to get to the end. We want to get to the end of the trilogy, and whether that's three or four, you know, or some other number, you know, it would be a whole number, you know. Obviously, it would be a whole rational number. I would have to imagine, but
pie seasons of the pie show. Seasons.
it'll just never end. Just, we're just watching 0.14159 episodes and it'll never end. The goal is to get to the end of the trilogy, and it seems like it would map out over probably certainly more than two seasons, but you know, beyond that it's hard to know exactly.
Kind of speaking on that front, I know there's not been a renewal yet, but Dan, have you kind of done any planning about what you want to tackle next and kind of mapping ahead?
Well, we don't have a second season, but we kind of need to keep pushing forward full steam ahead as if we did, because if we do get a second season, we'll need to hit the ground running in terms of pre-production and production to get it out to people in some kind of a reasonable time. These are, a show like this takes a long time to make, and you can't wait to get started thinking about it until somebody gives you the green light. So yeah, we've the second season, I think we have a pretty evolved sense of where it's going. We've been doing some work on that front. Subsequent seasons after that are a lot hazier, because it's once you really get into the weeds on a season of television that really takes all of your waking hours, and there's not much time left to be simultaneously plotting a third or a fourth season. So the short answer is yes, we've got a second season that is being kind of formulated and kept on deck in the event that we get the go ahead.
And then just finally, David, I know that there was a little bit of time when you guys were planning on working on Star Wars and that didn't work out. But if in the future kind of that presented itself to you again, do you think you'd be interested in that?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, when you've got a franchise that's already so well established, like Star Wars or James Bond or so forth, I think there's less independence when you come in to try to tell a story that you want to tell. And so I think what Dan and I have learned is that it's more fun for us to start something afresh, you know. So, and obviously we're coming in on the shoulders of Shishan Liu here. He's the one who created these novels and everything, but because we're the ones adapting them, at least for the English language, we have a lot of flexibility in terms of the story we want to tell. And that's a lot more fun for us than the other version.
So that was Three Body Problem, and all episodes are streaming now on Netflix. So Jane, what's your film of the week this week?
Robot Dreams, absolute banger. Everything this week has been fine. Mm. And that one is just sublime.
Yeah, I'd have to agree there. You've got a lot of, I've just pretty much enjoyed all these films really, but Robot Dreams in terms of the one that will have the most longevity with me and be revisited the most. Yeah, Robot Dreams for sure. So we're approaching the end of the podcast now, but keep your eyes peeled on social media for a look at the cover of the next issue of Total Film, which should be dropping any time now as you're listening to this. Ahead of the magazine going on sale next week. And if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice to help others find us. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question. Jane, based on this week, if we were to bring back another 80s film, what would you like to see resurrected?
I mean, what hasn't been resurrected? We've got Beetlejuice coming in. We've got another Top Gun. You know, I don't know if there's anything that hasn't been touched. But the one I think could do with a reassess, which is one that I love and a lot of people love, but then when you think about it, it's problematic, is Pretty Woman. Mm. I would like to see that gender flipped. I would like to see the idea of prostitution tackled a little bit better. And I think it could be quite interesting. I'd almost like to see Julia Roberts as the rich businesswoman picking up a young man. We could also like have an age disparity as well. So there were issues of that as well. Yeah, I sort of would like to see that story looked at again through a modern lens, because it's not really okay now. So that would be mine.
I'm going to allow you that, Jane, but I've just checked and Pretty Woman was 1990. But oh, I'm going to allow that as it's on the cusp and it's on those films, you know, that...
I just think of it as an 80s film.
Yeah, I mean, it does have an 80s vibe to it. I suppose, I mean, where are we drawing the line here? Because a film that kind of came to my mind, this to me feels like a 70s film, but it just about qualifies, is Airplane. Just simply because I haven't seen it for years, but that was one of those like go-to cheer yourself up films, much like the Naked Gun films for me, which I know are already getting a remake starring Liam Neeson, which I'm really, really not sure about. But I would like to see someone tackle an Airplane-style film again, where you just get joke after joke. I feel like they don't make them like that anymore, do they? Where you're literally just throwing jokes at the screen nonstop. So I've been intrigued to see someone do like a kind of spin on Airplane in that mold, where you're just updated for the present day and just literally throwing any jokes, and even if only like one in three work, you're still just laughing a hell of a lot because there's just so many.
And you could do throwbacks to some of the jokes that are just really, really good in Airplane. You know, I've mentioned this before, but I still find it hilarious when I watch that film, when that girl who's on the gurney, the air steward, starts singing a song with guitar and knocks her drip out. And while she's singing this song, the girl is like dying in the background. I'm even laughing, like properly laughing, thinking about it now. So yeah, I'd totally be up for that. I'd buy a ticket for that. I'd go for it. So let's commission that, please. Yeah.
So that's all from us this week. So thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye. Shake, shake, shake.